This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll remember Paul Bear Bryant. He was 16-4 against LSU at Alabama, 1958 to 1982. Did lose his first and last games against the Tigers when he was at the University of Alabama, but won a lot of games in between and won six national titles. We'll talk with George Morris, the veteran writer for The Advocate who covered the Bear, and John Ed Brantley, the celebrated writer who played against the Bear for LSU. Also, Dr. Nilima Reddy, a Baton Rouge gastroenterologist, on her work providing medical services for babies here and in other places, and Dr. Megan Sanders from the LSU Manship School of Mass Communication on the continuing challenges regarding diversity and the Oscar competition. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. And locally, 297-5633. Send us an email if you like to talk@talklouisiana.org. We begin with George Morris. For more than 35 years, he's been writing for Baton Rouge newspapers, first with the State Times, and for most of his career with The Advocate. And when he was with the State Times back in the year of 1982, when he joined the staff, it was one of LSU's best football seasons. And Jerry Stovall's Tigers beat a guy named Bear Bryant that year 20-10. And it was the last stand for Bear Bryant against LSU. But during his career, he was a Tiger tormentor, beating LSU at Alabama 16 out of 20 times. And he was certainly a thorn in the side of Charles Y. McClendon, who lost 14 of 16 games to his former coach at Kentucky, the fabled LSU coach who was the mentor to John Ed Brantley, a great writer who will be joining us in just a bit to talk about his memories of Bear Bryant. He played against him. George Morris, 35 years ago, January 26, 1982, Bear Bryant died in Tuscaloosa. He was 69. He seemed ancient at the time.
Well, yeah. Of course, I think part of that goes to the expression, it's not the years, it's the miles. I think that, and there's no secret that Bryant was not fastidious about taking care of himself. He was a smoker and he was a drinker. And I know that's not any great secret. And he had heart troubles. He had heart troubles, you know, even before the coronary that took his life. So, yeah, it was. I think it was 83. He died in 83.
Right.
I think you said 82, but
83. You started in 82.
Yes, I started in 82.
But he died January 26, 1983.
Yes.
So it's 35 years.
And yeah.
That is difficult to comprehend. I remember where I was when I heard he died.
Well, I mean, he was a larger-than-life figure in a way that you really can't be a larger-than-life figure today. There's so much exposure of everybody who's famous, and certainly college football coaches, but he was just legendary.
Mm-hmm. As he got older, he was not known for his quips. He was not a man of the verbosity that we've seen from Dale Duard Brown and many other SEC coaches in all sports. He was a man who didn't say a whole lot.
Well, no, and he said it in this real low, gravelly voice that sometimes he mumbled to the point that you couldn't understand it, even what he said. And,
that's correct.
Which again, I think contributed to his mystique and his legend. But no, but it was a different era. I mean, everything wasn't on TV and on radio, that lack of exposure compared to what we have now is kind of what gave him a mystique.
Well, before he became a very quiet man in his later years as a head coach, he was a more outspoken fellow. And here he is when he first became coach at Alabama, and you can hear from him why he was a great motivator. And it was a much different, younger Bear Bryant when he first became head coach at Alabama in 1958. And, of course, went crazy in the 1960s and 70s. His last 11 years between 71 and 81, his record in the conference, 69-4. Here's Bear Bryant in his prime.
Now, here's why you can win on little things, and we'll be talking with you about little things as long as you're here. On little things and a little something extra. Now, let's just suppose that we say that the maximum ability one can have is 100, that's the way we'll approach it. And let's say here I am, someone that really only has, based on that 100, a 75% or 75 ability. And here over here is someone that has 85 that I'm going to play against. Now, it takes everyone, but this is just for you, you as an individual. Now, on Saturday, by virtue of the fact that you have paid the price, you've learned those lessons, you work on the little things, you are willing to give a little extra. Although you only have 75% ability, you play a little over your head, and we expect you to. Okay, you play, and you'll be an 85 player that day. Now, here's another man over here that's playing against you. Now, this could happen. It don't always happen. That maybe he hasn't played the prize. Maybe he hasn't learned those lessons. Maybe he's not as dedicated as you are. And he doesn't play as well as he's supposed to play. And he falls off 10%. Or he falls off 10. He only plays 75. And that's just to illustrate my point. Then you, because of your preparation and the things I'm trying to get across to you, you can beat him because you paid 85. And if we do that as a team, 11 at the time, 4 years from now, you'll be walking out of here as a national champion. And I'll tell you this, I expect nothing less.
That was Paul Bear Bryant about a decade and a half before he died. And George Morris, you covered him near the time of his death. He didn't last even 2 months after he coached his last game. But he was a different man, but what a awe-inspiring figure on the sidelines.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even before the sidelines, I mean, he would famously lean up against the goalpost in the end zone watching his team warm up. And, I mean, there are photos of that from before and behind. I mean, they're just they're iconic photos. He won wherever he was. And, of course, he famously or infamously, you know, when he got to Texas A&M, that first year had the Junction Boys where he took all the players to a place out in the country around Junction, Texas. And the preseason workouts mm-hmm. were so hard that – legendarily, it took three buses to take him there and only one bus to bring him back because along the way, people just kept quitting. They couldn't take it. And in his later years, he actually was embarrassed about that. He realized that he had really been too hard and even brutal on those guys.
Mm-hmm. That first year, by the way, at A&M, he went 1-9, but 2 years later he had an undefeated team. So that right. shows what he could and did do with young men. Now, the date we're talking about, 35 years ago today, then we didn't have cell phones. The phone lines went down in Alabama because so many people were calling to talk about the death of the Bear.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I remember there's this wonderful photo that was in one of the Birmingham papers of a man who just gone out to the highway and was holding up a special edition of the paper that, you know, that Bear Bryant dead. And he's just, it's his way of, you know, grieving and informing people of mm-hmm. this monumental tragedy that for Alabama people, it was a monumental tragedy. The idea that Paul Bear Bryant was this immortal figure was suddenly mm-hmm. gone.
Well, in some parts of the South, it was like losing Elvis Presley, and Bear Bryant was 69. Elvis was only 42, but by today's standards, 69's a relatively young man, but he went fast after he coached his last game against Illinois in the Liberty Bowl. Wasn't one of his better teams, but he had a winning season, and he, other than the 1 year at A&M, all his seasons were winning, a remarkable record. What about the comparison with him and Nick Saban?
Well, I mean, I think certainly Nick Saban has brought himself into the mix of who are the greatest coaches of all time. Now, again, it was a different era. I don't think Nick Saban has the same sort of personal, you know, mystery and mystique that that Bryant did. Mm-hmm. You know, when you talk about Bryant, I mean, he had these different eras. Of course, he had, you know, that era at Alabama in the early 60s when they were, you know, winning three or four national championships. And he had quarterbacks like Joe Namath and Kenny Stabler and Scott Hunter, who did not go on to great things in the NFL. It was a very pro-style, for its day, you know, wide-open offense.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the 60s, they were really, really struggling. And, of course, he was somebody who was able to adapt. He looked at his talent and said, "What we could run the old T formation and be good." And he saw what Darrell Royal was doing at Texas, goes over to Texas, learns the wishbone, and then dominated the SEC until that last year.
And he had a scandal in his career. In fact, he said the Saturday Evening Post took 20 years off his life. He took it personally, and it was an embarrassment, and there's still a lot of mystery to that about him and Wally Butts. Did they fix a game?
You know, it's one of those, you know, intriguing stories. The thing that I've never had satisfactorily explained to me is why Wally Butts, why the athletic director at Georgia would be sabotaging his own team to an Alabama team that at the time was already superior to Georgia anyway. I'm not sure what the payoff would have been. I mean, you can assume that you know, gambling or something like that. But that's the one thing about that I've just always found, in addition to the oddity. I'm sorry, go ahead.
We'll be back after this pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number, and in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. We're joined now by John Ed Bradley, the celebrated writer from Opelousas and LSU, who has covered Bear Bryant and played against him. And we're remembering the Bear on the 35th anniversary of his death. John Ed Bradley, by the way, has written the definitive book to this point about LSU football, It Never Rains in Tiger Stadium. And one of his installments in Sports Illustrated was rated as one of the 60 best stories in the history of the magazine, and it was about his days at LSU. Good morning, John Ed Bradley.
Hey, Jim. Good to hear your voice.
Good to talk with you. You recall the Bear pretty well, don't you?
Oh, gosh, do I ever. I can't believe it's been 35 years since he's been gone, but yeah, we played against him four times when I was, you know, at LSU from 76 through 79. And he was there, you know, standing there in his houndstooth hat with his checkered coat, and he was quite a presence out on the field. I tell this story all the time. I was a senior, and we were playing Alabama in Tiger Stadium, and I rolled into him on the sideline and stood up. You know, there he was. You know, I'm looking into the eyes of Bear Bryant. But he was an incredible coach. He was a quite different from any coaches we have today. You know, people are comparing Nick Saban to Coach Bryant, but they were entirely different kinds of coaches, different kinds of people. It's one of my great memories playing against Bear Bryant.
Well, you know Nick Saban well as well, but did not play against him. And Bear Bryant was your height, 6'3". So when you stood up, you weren't towering over Bear Bryant the way you would Nick Saban. Is that part of the mystique? He was a former player, a very good player, by the way, at the University of Alabama. You could tell in his day he was quite a man.
He was. He had an aura about him. I tell you, there's just nobody like him today. He had a presence. You know, when we'd go out on the field to warm up, I was always looking for him. I was aware of where he was out on the, you know, on the field on the other side. And you know, he dressed well. He was a man of few words. He had that. He just had that presence. And I later, in 1982, I was a young writer for the Washington Post. I was working as a stringer, and my editor thought it would be a good idea for me to go to Alabama and to do a big feature story about Coach Bryant. So I go out there, I go to Tuscaloosa, and I arrange to spend some time with him, and I went into his office, and you know, there he was, and he was very, very polite and welcoming, and I went in, and I remember he had this really big desk. Mm-hmm. And right next to the desk on the floor was a console television, and he was watching cartoons. When I went I went into the office, he had a cartoon on. And I had this big list of questions to ask him, but the whole time he really interviewed me. He wanted to know about where I was from and what my mom and dad were like and who were my brothers and sisters. So I think the story suffered because of that, but it was quite a thing to sit with him. And you know, I had met him before. Coach Mack and I flew to Birmingham for the Birmingham Touchdown Club Player of the Year Awards, and I was the representative for LSU, and we went out there. Coach Mack had played for Bear Bryant. And we were in this hotel, and we went down. Coach Mack got me, and we went down into the lounge. And there he was. He was sipping on a glass of whiskey, you know, and Coach Mack was excited to see him. They didn't hug or anything, but, you know, Coach Bryant just didn't have a whole lot to say. They were very cordial toward each other. Mm-hmm. But it was something for me. He had not recruited me when I was in high school. He recruited a couple of guys I played with at LSU. But he was just this iconic, larger-than-life, heroic guy who everybody seemed to respect. Some were reverential toward him. There's no doubt about it. He was a football god.
Yeah.
You know, at Alabama, the coaches there, all his assistants were, you know, they were just, they would do anything for him. It's funny how he commanded that kind of respect. People seem to adore him. Mm-hmm. It's funny. Coach Mack was heavily criticized for not being able to beat the Bear. But he wasn't intimidated by Coach Bryant. We went into every game believing we were going to win it, and that includes the games with Alabama. My senior year, they beat us 3-0.
Yeah, well, that 3-0 game, that was an Alabama team that won the national title, went undefeated, and I was a student, and Coach Mack was very kind to provide an interview, and he said to me, this is the biggest game of my career. I said, are you just saying that because it's the next game? He says, no, this is the biggest game in my career.
Yeah.
And he lost 3-0.
I believe you. I know he would have said that. He pretty much said that to us. I don't think he wanted to put too much pressure on us, but we went in there thinking we would win. We had played USC really close earlier, and they were, USC and Alabama were the top programs in the country that year. And we gave Alabama and the Bear a hell of a game, but the field was a mess. It was cold and raining. I'm sure you remember that, Jim. And we just could not get any offense going. They couldn't either. You know, they couldn't get much going, but I always wondered if, you know, had we won that game, would it have saved Coach Mack's job? You know, I doubt it. But I think he believed that. Mm-hmm. I think he wanted that to be so. But it was a tough one to lose. We were very discouraged after that game.
Well, we have George Morris with us, and a few more minutes with George and John Ed Bradley. And this is one for both of you. Do you think he could survive in today's environment? Would he still be as successful?
Well, I think yes. I mean, I think he was an extraordinary coach, and as we were talking about before, he completely changed how he did football in the 60s. It was more of a pro-style attack. When that ceased to work, he became a wishbone coach. He was, and among the wishbone coaches, he was one of the first that I ever saw who they talked about breaking mm-hmm. the bone, taking one of the halfbacks and splitting them wide so that he could make more of a passing attack. He was a very versatile coach.
John Ed, would he still be the Bear?
Absolutely. You know, he recruited so well, and he attracted greatness. He was even though he was not the most loquacious guy, people just flocked to him, and he was able to go into a home and sign a guy, you know, sign a recruit. I can tell you that their second team players were every bit as good as their first team guys. So he was recruiting well. He was good to his staff. He paid them well. You know, coaches back then didn't make much money. Mm-hmm. You know, Coach Mack made around $90,000 his last year at LSU. It's hard to believe, but that's all he made for the whole year. But he was, Coach Bryant had good coaches. He had great players. He instilled in them, you know, a class, a way to conduct themselves. When you're out there playing, you know who you're playing against. I mean, the character of your opponent comes through at some point in the game. And they were guys who, you know, they played hard on every down.
Every down. Well, we've got to roll, guys. But, John Ed, thank you for joining us. And George Morris, John Ed Bradley and George Morris, two of the best at what they do. And we're remembering Bear Bryant 35 years after his death. We're back after this pause with more Talk Louisiana on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Allie Baltazar is producing. Your number is 877-217-5757. We're joined by Nilima Reddy. Dr. Reddy is a Baton Rouge gastroenterologist, and she is involved in healthcare not only here but in other places, and she came this way from her native country of India. We'll hear from one of her colleagues also from India in just a moment. But Dr. Nilima Reddy is involved in assisting public hospitals and providing basic medical services for babies, and this is something that is relevant to this country and to others. And tell us about how you got involved in this, Dr. Reddy.
Thank you so much, Jim, for giving us this opportunity. And Dr. Sai is my classmate from medical school, and she has always been an altruistic person. She's a pediatrician, and in India, the healthcare system has public hospitals where everything is free, but you may not get everything. So children were dying unnecessarily due to lack of basic resources, working equipment, or shortage of staff and medications. So when she saw that, she started this organization called ECOM. ECOM is, in Sanskrit, it means oneness, because we all come together as one to save the children. So that's how she started it, and since I have known her from medical school days to be a completely giving and dedicated person, I wanted to support this work. We started the organization here. We are now a 501c3 certified organization called ECOM USA, and we support all the work that's being done there.
ECOM USA, and we will hear from Dr. Sai in just a moment, but this is, I'm told, affected positively the infant mortality rate.
Yes, that is the infant mortality rate, is how many infants, that is less than 1 year old children, die per the 1,000 children that are born. So that is a measure of the health index of a country. And unfortunately, in some countries, it is very high. In India, even, it is 42 per 1,000 children. So in the state where ECOM operates, the infant mortality rate was 21, and now they have reduced it to 16 per 1,000. It is still a high number for us, but that shows how successful the model was, in terms of not just treating one child at a time, but the system of reinforcing the existing public health system. So what resources we have, we would like to make them more cost efficient by providing more staff and training more nurses, as well as maintaining the equipment in working condition. like if you have a ventilator and it doesn't work, it doesn't do just that. It doesn't help us anyone. It's a waste of money that's put in the hospital. Whereas when we go and use our individual donors' money to maintain that ventilator, you save a lot of lives. When the child comes in, the government funds will support the room and the rent and the food. And for the nurses, we are just maintaining that ventilator saves a lot of lives. So we have directly supported 12,000 children since 2009 and paid for their medical treatments, hospitalization, ICU care, et cetera, when the patients cannot afford it.
Well, you'll be joined in Baton Rouge by Dr. Sai Lakshmi. She is also involved with this quite intricately, and she will be joining us. But tell us about the event this weekend.
So she's visiting Baton Rouge on January 28th, the Sunday, 6 to 8 p.m. We have an open event where everyone is welcome to come and listen to a presentation by her of how exactly they're achieving these results, this reduction in the child mortality. She, being a pediatrician herself, knows the challenges. We face some of those challenges here, too, in a different sort of way. And it may be something for both of us to learn, both countries to work on a similar model. So she'll be here from 6 to 8 p.m., followed by dinner, so everyone is invited. It's at 6221 Equity Drive in Baton Rouge, and the information is available on our website, EKAMUSA, that's www.ekamusa.org, where the details can be found, and it is a wonderful opportunity to meet this amazing person and know more about the work being done.
Now, you met Dr. Lakshmi in med school, correct?
Yes.
And she is a pediatrician who is coming this way. And where are you based now, Dr. Lakshmi?
I am based out of Chennai, India. And I'm currently visiting multiple cities in U.S., and currently I am in Ohio.
Okay. You're in Ohio, but you'll be in Baton Rouge Sunday night, 6 o'clock. This is open to the public. 6221 yes. Equity Drive is the address, and it's about the EKAM Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization trying to help children by providing life-saving equipment and other medical care for kids. How significant is this issue, not only in your home country, but in the United States, states based on what you have seen?
Yeah, it is a very important issue, and which is not very visually seen because they're all newborns who are actually, you know, dying. Like in India, as Dr. Neelima was mentioning, the mortality is quite high. In U.S. too, there is now it is rising because of various other reasons. It need not be the infant, but there are a lot of children deaths happening because of overdosage of drugs. And I've heard that depression too is playing a very significant role here. But compared to India, obviously, U.S. has the neonatal mortality rate is quite low.
All right. And you, Dr. Reddy, have been in Baton Rouge 10 years by way of India. How did you make the journey here? What was the reason for your arrival in our fair city?
We know that the U.S. was leading in terms of medical training, so I wanted to further my training and education. So I came to Birmingham University of Alabama to do my internal medicine and gastroenterology training, and we stayed in the warm weather in Baton Rouge, where I love it. So we've been doing this for a long time, but I think it's time to go beyond just the traditional healthcare. Where Sai Lakshmi was saying, when we say children, we mean up to adolescence, up to 19 years of age, and that's when we see the same problems, whether it's in India or U.S. or all over the world, about depression and drug use and all. So we're actually starting a youth ambassador program where we want to involve young adults along with their parents in a value-based education and mentorship model where they can actually learn some of the work and the values that are integrated with EKAM. And while spreading the word about EKAM, we want to give them the tools where they are more capable of maintaining and facing some of the challenges they do these days and not succumb to stress or drugs or any of these. That's one of our goals, to see what we can do in this country to prevent problems in this population, this pediatric population up to 19 years of age. That's one of our goals. And she's had a very good response while she's traveling across the U.S., and we were able to start about 40 local chapters in different cities where people that have been inspired by her presentation have come forward to take this mission forward.
And for those interested in the event Sunday night, what's the best way to contact you?
They can go on the website, ekamusa.org, E-K-A-M-U-S-A, or just Google for ekamusa, and they should see the information on the website. It's 6 to 8 p.m., and they can find all the other information about the work we do and the donation options, because we really want to forward a Mission 1000, which is we need 1,000 donors that would do $20 a month, and that would be our Save a Child program, which pays directly for the medical costs, including the treatment and drugs and lab investigations and hospitalization costs of children that cannot afford. As an example, we had a parent who earns like up to $40 a month, and there is no way he can afford to pay a $1,000 ICU stay for a newborn that needs a ventilator and ICU care. So that is where ACOM, the way it works, by working with the public hospitals as well as the private system and the individual donors, they obtained a discount of 50% from the hospital and paid the rest of the money through individual donations. So ACOM does any child where they operate can pick up a helpline and ask for help and will be treated. And that is how we've achieved the results that we have.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Reddy. It's been a pleasure, and we look forward to seeing you in Baton Rouge Sunday night, where you spend most of your time, and you'll be joined by Dr. Sai Lakshmi, who comes this way from India. We appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tim.
And we're joined now by Dr. Megan Sanders. She is with the Manship School of Mass Communication. She researches the psychological effects of mass media as they pertain to psychological and subjective well-being and enjoyment and appreciation of entertainment. And she's here today to talk about primarily regarding the controversy swirling about the Oscars. And this year we did see a few women and some African-Americans nominated for the Oscars. This has been an issue. Do you think the diversity issue is being addressed appropriately by Hollywood, Dr. Sanders?
Well, I think it's baby steps. Since 2005, everyone's familiar with the hashtag #OscarsSoWhite movement, where African-Americans in particular were really upset with the whitewashing of nominees in the major performance categories. And so I think, as with any movement that people are involved in, they hope to see some changes come about as a result. And I think you're seeing some of that happening now, just probably not at the level in which most people would hope it would happen.
We're visiting with Dr. Megan Sanders. The Oscar nominations were announced this week, and we will talk with her about those announcements, and there were some minorities included. This is an interesting development, because the Academy, which determines who wins these, remains 72% male and 87% white. Your number is 877-217-5757. Locally, it is 297-5633. You can send us an email, talk@talklouisiana.org, and we'll return with more of Talk Louisiana after this 2-minute pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're with Dr. Megan Sanders, associate professor and researcher in the Media Effects Lab at LSU's Manship School of Mass Communication. She's been at LSU for 11 years, graduate of Dillard University and Penn State, where she received her PhD, and she's here talking about diversity issues regarding the Oscars, and this has been something that's been permeating for some time. And as noted, 87% of the people who vote for these awards are white. And this year we have seen some movement toward more women and more African Americans being nominated. Is it a necessity that we have more of them win the awards for the Oscars to be truly diverse?
I think it's a bit of both. There has to be a combination of acknowledgement in terms of nominations, but also saying that you are the best of the best this year in your industry, in your field, whether that's as in a performance or with cinematography or directing. I think that just about anyone, if there is an award that's being given in their industry, they like to be acknowledged for the great work that they're doing. And I think that's really important, acknowledging people for their work, regardless of what their skin color may be or what their gender may be.
Well, the University of Southern California examined 1,000 films between 2007 and 2017, and only 4% were directed by women, 5% directed by African Americans. So it appears that Hollywood, like many other places, is largely a bastion of white men.
Exactly. And that's not, those aren't new numbers. Historically, it's been that way. And I think it is a testament. I think there is a connection to who's in the driver's seat, who's in the position to not only decide which stories are being told, but how those stories are being told. And when you don't have many people of color in the director's seat or many women in the director's seat, it does influence what we're seeing. It influences the media that we have exposure to, Hollywood and entertainment and movies, as we spend a lot of money watching mm-hmm. movies, whether we're going to the theaters or subscribing to streaming services. And so it's a really huge industry, and it has an impact on not only perceptions of the world around us, but also can have impact on how we perceive ourselves.
There's been a lot of buzz about the film Get Out. Did you see it?
I did see it, and it's been a great week for Jordan Peele. He ranked on Twitter, he ranked the nominations right up there with his six-month-old son sleeping through the night for the first time. So he's having a really great week, and it's getting a lot of attention. A lot of people are saying that it's warranted attention, but also a bit surprising given the time of year that the film was released.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was nominated for 5 different awards, mm-hmm. so this is a film, for those who haven't seen it, can you give us the Cliff Notes version?
Let's see if I can do that without giving any spoilers. It is a horror film, but it is a comedic horror film, so it is a satire that provides some social commentary on suburban racism. So I'll just stop there so mm-hmm. that I don't spoil the plot.
All right. A listener, Holly, asks about the revelations that a lot of sexual misconduct's been going on in Hollywood, mm-hmm. too. Does that dovetail with the concerns about diversity? Are those two unrelated, or is there a connection?
I believe they're very much related, insofar as there's a correlation between the sexual misconduct that seems to run rampant in many areas and many industries right now. In Hollywood in particular, it's directly related to which stories aren't being told, which films aren't making it to production, which films aren't making it quite to distribution and making it to the audiences. I think that when it comes to women and women of color who may have experienced sexual harassment, there are so many women that we probably don't even know about. We're just starting to skim the surface, and they have changed careers. They've changed what they want to do. They don't no longer want to tell the stories and be involved in Hollywood. And I do think that that's related to what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. Tracy asks, how many members are there in the Academy? And I am reading from the New York Times. It says there are 8,400 members. I thought there might be more, but only 8,400 members. Mm-hmm. This is the 90th annual awards ceremony, and I would imagine there will be a lot of stump speeches from the stage. We may have some people announcing their candidacy for offices. There are a lot of issues that are going on right now. And some find this a good thing, and others find it a source of disappointment that entertainment is now blended so intricately with politics.
I don't think that's something new. I think entertainment has always been blended with politics and social life in general. There are many films that we could think about in the past that have tackled very, very challenging and difficult social issues. So I don't think we're seeing anything new. It could seem like it's a new phenomenon because of the amount of information that we now have at our disposal, and the mechanisms through which we access information are drastically larger mm-hmm. than they used to be.
Here's another question from Cody about whether the Oscars really matter when it comes to race relations. Does that really matter to our country, which has 325 million people, who wins or doesn't win best actor or best actress or best picture?
In the grand scheme of things, it seems like it just may not matter all that much. But the research that I'm doing in the Media Effects Lab, along with colleagues at Penn State and Florida State and Chapman University in California, we're finding that exposure to some of these stories, some of these films that are very artistic in nature and that tackle some of these very difficult issues do have an impact on how we relate to individuals who are dissimilar from ourselves. Mm-hmm. When we are challenged emotionally, when we see these stories being told, it tends to open us up a little bit more to others' experiences. And we also want to share those experiences with those that we're closest to. So in that way, it can have some impact on race relations.
It sounds like you watch a few films.
Just a few.
What were your favorites from the past year?
My favorites from the past year, loved Mudbound. It had me ugly crying. So we'll just leave it at that. I really enjoyed Get Out. So I was very excited to see it getting all of the attention that it was getting. The Big Sick was also a personal favorite. And it was one that I waited quite a few months to see. I missed it at Sundance and was very happy to see it showing at Baton Rouge. So I would say those are probably some of my favorites this year.
Now, Greta Gerwig, she is nominated for Lady Bird. What would that mean if she were to win?
It would be historic. One, there's only one other female director who's won in that category, and that's Kathryn Bigelow in 2010 for The Hurt Locker. So Greta Gerwig would be the second woman to win for directing. But I think it's also the symbolism that it represents. It tells the industry that your voices matter as women, as female directors, mm-hmm. as directors of color. Your perspective and your mode of storytelling matters to us, and it was really, really good. We value the perspective that you're bringing to the director's chair.
Another film that John Wirt, who sat in your chair a few weeks ago, talked about, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. He listed that as one of his best films for 2017. This one has certainly some diversity and has appears to be gaining some momentum.
It really has. I haven't seen it, so I can't comment on the plot or the performances, unfortunately. But it really is turning into kind of the bell of the award season. We're seeing a lot of attention for it as a film as a whole, but also the individual performances with Frances McDormand and others who participated in the film. So that's really exciting to see for them.
And another listener points out that a gay romance story, Call Me By Your Name, is one of the nominees. This is for Best Picture, isn't it?
I believe so. Call Me By Your Name was a Sundance favorite in 2017. And it's the story of a young man kind of coming into his own in regards to his sexuality while abroad in Italy. So it's also gaining a lot of attention, not just for the performances, but the nature of the story being told and the way in which the story was told.
Could this be a bellwether year in terms of a shift in diversity?
I think it's a start. Last year, we saw the largest number of African Americans nominated in the performance mm-hmm. categories. We see some similar numbers coming out this year. If you think about diversity in its widest definition possible, but we're also seeing a difference in the nature of the movies and the performances that are being nominated. It's unusual for a horror film to be nominated for as many categories as we saw this year with Get Out. So I think as the makeup of the Academy changes, we're starting to see some differences in what kinds of films and what types of performances that they're paying attention to.
Do you think more people will be watching this year based on the prospect of some kind of a news-breaking item happening at the ceremony itself?
Quite possibly, especially given what happened last year with the gaffe of announcing the wrong winner for the best film category. So there could be more mm-hmm. viewers this year simply because of that.
I thought under the circumstances, Warren Beatty handled that pretty well. It wasn't a very comfortable place to be.
It really wasn't. It was uncomfortable to watch as a viewer.
Yeah, but I think some heads rolled, too. Price Waterhouse, amazingly, I think, kept the kept the assignment. So yeah, we'll see what happens this year. But thank you for joining us, Dr.
Thank
Megan
Sanders.
Thank you
so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. We'll be back Monday, same time, same place. Until then, thank you for listening. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.